Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. I also want to thank Dina and David Steinberg for sponsoring this whole series on Israel. And we greatly appreciate your support. And look forward to be able to share words of Torah in loving memory of Samuel Ehrenholt. By a show of hands, I also want to make one other announcement, and that is that our goal is that the last Kol Medreshet Yom Rishon, either right before Shavuot or maybe after Shavuot, we'll focus on the Torah of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. We think it's only appropriate that we should spend some time on that focus. And then, please God, in Elul, we'll have a full Yom Iyun on a Sunday, but we want to focus Kol Medreshet Yom Rishon at least on some of the Torah. Heard from some of his Talmidim, some of the Rashi Yeshiva here, as well as other Torah personalities within the YU orbit. So stay tuned for details on that. By a show of hands, I had the privilege of talking on a similar topic when we had a Yom Iyun in December, and I did not get through all of it. I just want to know, by a show of hands, how many people were at my presentation on that? One. Okay. Two. All right. Some ways it makes it easier, and some ways it makes it harder. Okay. Okay. So here's what I'd like to do. With your permission, David, if I can actually spend more than a few minutes reviewing the first part of the lecture, which is what I did, and then go into a new material that he did not hear. If you open up, there are two handouts that you have. Everyone have two handouts? One is in lieu of a PowerPoint presentation, since this room is not so great with that, and one are Makorot. The thicker one is the PowerPoint, and the thinner one are the Makorot. We're going to use the following. We're going to start with the thicker one. We're going to start with the visual presentation, and then we will refer to the Makorot as we go on. And if you notice, and I think it's going to be important that you notice this, there is pagination on the bottom, so you will be able to refer to various different slides or pictures based on the pagination of the presentation. So this is really critical to have these Makorot. Anyone not have the Makorot? Okay. A thin package with Makorot, a larger package with a visual presentation. Necessary to have both. Okay. So, page number 2 of the visual presentation shows you, it's just a copy of the Holy Land, what used to be at the Holy Land Museum, which is Holy Land Hotel, which is now at the Israel Museum. And that is a dugma, a model of the Beit HaMikdash. And if you notice, the Beit HaMikdash, the temple stood where it's indicated so. We face the back of the temple normally with the Kotel HaMaravi, with the Western Wall. There was an area to the south of it where it says enter and exit here, just to get your bearings straight. Where the enter and exit here sign is, that's the south. Opposite is the north. This picture is facing the east, and behind the Beit HaMikdash was the west. And the major thoroughfare of entrance for non-Kohanim was through the south, through the southern wall. You would enter in a certain area, you would then exit onto the temple plaza, and you would then walk to the Beit HaMikdash itself. If you turn to the next page, you will see some of those gates from the southern wall still there. They're called the Chulda Gates. They're named after Chulda for two reasons. Either because of the prophetess Chulda, who spoke about the respect and dignity that one needed to have in the Beit HaMikdash, or because Chulda means a weasel, and if you look at the underground passageway that the southern wall takes you, it meanders like a weasel travels, and therefore they were called the Chol Degates. You see a little bit still, this is a picture of what the modern southern wall looks like. You see a little bit of the southern wall, Chol the Double Gates. And if you turn to the next page, you'll see that there are, now we're at page 4 of the visual presentation, you'll see that there are both double gates and triple gates. Does everyone see that there, where it says double gates and triple gates? It's pretty well elucidated. The double gates were the exit gates. They were the gates in which Jews would leave the Beit HaMikdash, or anyone would leave the Beit HaMikdash. And the triple gates is where the Jews would enter. Three gates to enter, two gates to exit. People came on time to the Beit HaMikdash, and therefore you needed more gates to enter than exit. In our shuls, it would be reverse. Two gates to enter because people stagger in. Three gates because everyone leaves by Adon Olam. But the bottom line is, there were triple gates and double gates. And again, out of respect to those who've heard some of this already, and I want to move to new material, I'm not going to go through every piece of this, but I think there is some importance to this. I'd like to point your attention to a few things on this page, on page 4. But first, I'd like to ask you to move to page 5, and we'll move back to page 4. And that is that on page 5, you'll notice that those steps in the lower picture are to the triple gates, which is, again, the gates in which the Jews entered. These are the gates that are on the southeast corner of the southern wall, the southeast corner. Notice the fact that all of those steps are newly manufactured, newly cemented steps. And if you look at the upper picture on page 5, you will notice that those are ancient steps from the time of the second Beit HaMikdash. They're 2,000 plus years old. And we have no steps left from the entrance into the Beit HaMikdash, from the triple gates, but we have all of the remnant steps, basically, from when the Jews descended from the Beit HaMikdash. Why is that? I'm not going to call on you to ask if you remember from December. Why is that? Because when you entered into the Beit HaMikdash, we wanted to make sure that there was no tumah, there was no ritual impurity that could affect you. And therefore, the steps were actually designed on arches. So when the arches crumbled, so did the steps. But the exiting steps did not need the sophistication of being built on arches, so that if there was any tumah below, that it would compromise your person. You didn't need that when you exited, you only needed that when you entered. So therefore, there are no steps left from the entering process, but we really have the remnant steps from the exiting process. You notice something about the steps, which is true both, again, we're still on page 5 of the visual presentation. You'll notice something about those steps, right? Rabbi Goldberg, what? Wider and narrow. They didn't fit the American Disabilities Act. Why is that? Wider and narrow? Well, they were also the same steps that were used to enter in, wider and narrow. They were the same steps. It's just some of them we have, some of them we don't have. We don't have the ones to enter because, as I said before, they were built on arches so that if there was tumah below, the arches would be chotzeis, would in some ways interfere with that tumah rising and affecting the pedestrian traffic entering into the Beit HaMikdash. Why are the steps like this? Sniut would maybe mean that they should be very small, so a person walks very carefully, not that they're so wide. You're close. Anyone else? Sniut? No? It is because we wanted to make sure... Sorry? You could not run into the Beit HaMikdash. That you needed to be able to have kavanah, you needed to have some type of mindset. And the reason why the American Disabilities Act requires you to make sure that all steps are properly measured is because you have the wherewithal just to basically run up those steps without any memory or focus. That is not the intention here. The intention here is just the opposite. You shouldn't be able to run into the Beit HaMikdash and engage in a relationship with God without proper reflection. And therefore the steps were set up in a way that they were large and small, which deters one from running up them simply because they are not organized as such. And if we go back to page 4 of our visual presentation, let me just walk you through a few other things here, and then we'll get into some of the Makorot. You see a few other things here. You see, first of all, things that we're not going to talk about because they're newer. The Byzantine wineries, a Byzantine street. You see burnt Herodian arches of vaulted rooms. Those burnt Herodian arches are exactly underneath the steps entering into the Beit HaMikdash. Those are the arches that I discussed with you, the arches that were created in order to make sure that the tumah, if there was any tumah below, a dead carcass of an animal or something else of that nature, you know, in Teaneck right now, everyone's talking about coyotes, right now. Dead coyote there or something like that, they would not in any ways, I'm sorry? Central Park also, it would not be chotzeit. You see, like, a pilgrim's hospice. Well, you're right. Any tumah, the rules of tumah were pretty rigorous. Any tumah would be avoided. I was just trying to make a joke in the process, but you're 100% correct. And that is, those arches actually stopped one from creating any forms of tumah that would rise, whatever they were, and that's why they were structured in the way they were structured. Okay? Or whatever. You know, we have to go through all the laws of tumah tahara to see if they affected it. Okay? You notice there is a comment here that is actually a little bit wrong, and that is, on the left-hand side, large mikvah used by the priest, that's not correct. It's a large mikvah, as there are many mikvot. The Kohanim did not use these mikvot. The Kohanim had other mikvot. First of all, they had mikvot on the Beit HaMikdash itself. And their entrance was primarily from the upper city of Yerushalayim, where there were a plethora of mikvot. If anyone ever spends any time in the old city of Jerusalem, and you're in the Rachva there, in the courtyard there, you'll notice, I'm just trying to explain it because the restaurant's names have changed so often. You'll notice that there is, on one corner of the Rachva, there's an ATM. On the opposite side of that Rachva, area there in the center, where you would walk as an entrance to Yeshivat HaKotel, there's actually just a green door. It doesn't look like it leads to anywhere. But actually leads, you can try to open it. It actually leads to below where there's actually a mikvah from the time of the second Beit HaMikdash. And if you walk through the Yeshivat HaKotel, you'll notice the wall archaeological center there, and there is a plethora of homes, all from the Kohanim, that had their own private mikvot so that they could eat the truma or anything else they were able to eat b'tahara. And there's several different things there. If you notice, there's actually a mailbox, actually from the time of the British Mandate there, and there are very large stones from the Herodian period, stones that were really the same walkways that they would use, the Kohanim would use, to walk down from the upper city to the Beit HaMikdash itself. Why do I mention this mikvah? Because if you turn to page 6 of our handout, you'll notice pictures of the mikvot from the southern wall. These are standard depictions, which we're going to get into the sources in a few minutes. I just want to make sure that for David and one or two others, we hear that we don't just do chazara, but we do new material. And that is that you notice that there was an entrance and an exit, and there was a wall, which was slightly larger. It was larger than this. This is 2,000 years old. Halavai, our mikvahs that we build now should look this good after 2,000 years. And you would enter in one way, and you would exit another way, and that was to make sure the people walking in who were Tameh wouldn't touch the people who had just become Tar. So there was a wall between them. You can see remnants of that wall on page 6, and there are several mikvos of this nature all throughout the southern wall from the time of the second Beis HaMikdash. And it totally makes sense that those are there, simply because in process of entering onto the Beis HaMikdash, you would go through a process of tahara. You also see on page 4, again, things we're not going to touch right now, the eastern wall line from the time of Nehemiah. And actually, if you look carefully, you can also see things from walls that were built in the time of Shlomo HaMelech. And actually, if you look actually in the lower part of this area, you could actually see walls that were from the time of the Jebusites, from the Yevusim, the time of Avram Avinu. But we're just going to focus on the Second Temple period. With this in mind, let's open up our handout and start looking at some of the Makorot. So first, on page 2 of your handout, there's just a little summary of the history of Yerushalayim and the Temple Mount, an important thing for you to have. We'll refer to this on occasion, but either way, it's good to have. And let's look at some of the Mishnayos. And again, I apologize, I do not want to focus all the time on just, even though it's very few people who were at the first presentation, I want to make sure there's new material discussed. But let's look at source number one. Chamisha sha'arim hayu laharabayit. There were 5 gates that entered into the harabayit. Shnei sha'arei chulda. There were the chulda gates min ha'darom. They were from the darom. They were from the south, the southern wall. Mishamshim kenisa v'yitzia. They were entrance and exits. Kipanos min ha'marav. Kipanos, which was a gate that was in the west. We can see actually remnants of those western gates. You can actually see it if you go into the women's section, not something I suggest that you do on a regular basis. But if you go at 2 a.m., it's pretty good to go. The women's section, if you go into the entrance of the women's section, where the area that is of the women's section that is not, that is covered, you'll notice as you enter, there's actually a keystone which really supported an arch into the gate, into the Beit HaMikdash. That's the Kipanos gate. It's right near the gate that's there right now, min ha'marav, v'shamish k'nisa v'yitzida, tedi min ha'tzafon. There was a northern gate known as Shar Tedi, lo'haya m'shamish klum, didn't have any role. So why was it there? There are two different approaches. One is that if a Kohen had any type of instantaneous tumah, he was able to depart immediately through that gate. But the more pervasive commentary given in the Mishnayos of Yachin Boaz, and Rabbi William Schwartz will appreciate this as a member of the Reitz board, and that is that Teddy was a gate that was actually, when someone wanted to make a donation to build the Beit HaMikdash, he insisted on a gate. This is the commentary, this is not a modern commentary. Look at the Yachin Boaz on this Mishnah. And he insisted on a gate, and they named a gate for him, Shar Teddy. It had no purpose other than serving as a financial incentive to support the Torah and the activities of the Beit HaMikdash. But some things have never changed, right? In Shar Mizrahi, the eastern gate, Alav Shushan HaBira, there was a picture of Shushan HaBira, and that was to show respect for the fact that the of the permission to rebuild the second Beis HaMikdash by the king in Shushan HaBira. If you turn to actually page 2 of our visual handout, you will see that the temple is supposed to be opposite this gate known as Shar Shushan. The only problem is that what we have now as the gate in the eastern wall actually does not line up to where most of the scholars think is actually Mul Kodesh Kedashim, opposite Kodesh Kedashim. So that actually brings a little bit of a problem. Some therefore suggest that the Dome of the Rock is not where the Kodesh Kedashim was, but rather it was more to the north. And there's actually another rock form that has the same height as the Dome of the Rock, which the Arabs call in their Masorah the Dome of the Tablets, where some suggest that that is actually Mul Kodesh Kedushim, that it's not the Dome of the Rock. A different explanation, which was probably is a more feasible one, but they're both out there, is that we've done very little archaeology on the, or really no archaeology, on the eastern side, because there is an Arab cemetery there. And doing archaeology in a place in which there is any cemetery would cause, without any exaggeration, an international incident. So while we have a gate there, we don't know if that is a newer gate than the gate of what we would call Shar Shushan, the eastern gate. And since we've done no work in that area, we can't discover that. There are tefillot from the early periods of the medieval era that mention actually multiple gates in the eastern wall. And even though we're only familiar with one, it could be there were multiple gates and that we have not yet uncovered the Shar Shushan in any way, shape, or form. That's just an important idea that we should mention. Going back to our sources, we see that if we look at the next Mishnah in source number one, called Nichnasim Laharabayas, Nichnasim Derech Yamin, Makifin, Viyotzim Derech Smol. You would enter in from the right, from the three gates, and you would exit from the left gates. There are some exceptions to that traffic pattern. We're not going to get into that now. If we look at source number two, we also are introduced to the fact that the Sanhedrin was exiled from being in the Lishkas Hagazis, from being in the center of the Temple Mount, to the Chanut, to another area, and then from Chanut to Yerushalayim and Yerushalayim to Yavne. That's source number two on page three of our handout. Where is this Chanut? The Chanut is actually, if you look at page two of your visual presentation, the Chanut is between the enter here and exit here, where the mosque is right now. There are two mosques on the Temple Mount, where the mosque is right now, between the enter and exit areas on source number two. That is exactly where the Chanut was. That is the first station, so to say, of the Galut of Sanhedrin, which eventually goes to Yavne, and then eventually up north. Okay, why is it called the Chanut? Why is it called the Chanut? It is called the Chanut because it was a store. It was a place in which, as you entered onto the temple plaza, you were able to switch out different monies to be able to get your proper shkalim. You were able to, so you could buy your animals and things of that nature. If you were coming from Washington Heights to make Aliyat LeRegel, you could not bring your karbonot with you, right? And therefore, you needed to have the right monies. You exchanged the monies. In fact, by the way, again, this is not found in the Gemara, but it's an important piece. When you ask in Hebrew, what is the rate of exchange? What's the Hebrew words? Mahashar. What does the word shar mean? Gate. It is because it was at the gates that there was the money changing. That is why the Hebrew word now, mahashar, what is the exchange? It is based on the fact that at the southern gate and other gates of other cities is where the exchange would happen for monies. That's where the modern Hebrew word, what is the exchange rate? Because shar does not make any sense, but it does make sense if you understand the sources here. Okay. Let's move back to our visual presentation. I want to point out source number seven. In source number seven, you have an aerial view. So you see that mosque that I've been talking about, not the Dome of the Rock, the other mosque, that is where the Chanut was, or partly where the Chanut was, on page 7 of our visual presentation. And I highlight an area that is circled in red here, and that is the fact that we know that at different times we had authority over the Temple Mount area, and one time in which we had authority over the Temple Mount area for a short period of time. We know, for example, that the Karban Pesach was brought even after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash until the Bar Kokhba period. The Netziv and others bring it down, and we have historical views for that also. But we know that there was a certain period of time where the Jews were able to had control over the Temple Mount. If you look at page 2 of our sources, from 614 to 617 CE, the Persians conquested Jerusalem and gave Jews control over the Temple Mount. Source 2b of your visual presentation shows you the fact that we actually found coins and other medallions from that exact period of time, which corroborates the time in which we once again had ownership over the Beit HaMikdash. We've actually found Byzantine-era coins with unique menorah medallions. You can go to Time of Israel yourself and read the whole article on that. We're going to move now to the next page of our visual presentation. We'll skip page 8, not because there's not much to say on it, because I want to make sure that we spend some time on some new material that I didn't present in December. But I want to mention a page 9, and here is based on the Soreg. Every human being was permitted to enter into the Temple Mount to pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And if I can, just for a moment, deviate and highlight the idea that when David HaMelech speaks about the consecration of the Beit HaMikdash, although he was not alive, but he puts together, he speaks about the idea that it was a place for all human beings to connect to God, that we're concerned about all human beings. I think it is important that we just take a moment and ask ourselves that in our tefillot today, with everything, the tragedies that happened in India, and the fact that so many human beings, Jews and non-Jews, have been injured and killed, that we find a few moments to have them in mind. We don't want the world to negate and forget us. We have to make sure that we don't forget other human beings. And on the Beit HaMikdash, there was this idea that anyone could go onto the Beit HaMikdash and pray to God, but there were different levels. The same way the Kohanim could only enter into certain places, and the Machne Yisrael, Yisraelim, could not, Jews and non-Jews had different places where they could enter. And there was something called the Soreg, where the Mishnah in Midot, source number 3 of our Mekorot, highlights. And source number 3 of the Mekorot indicates, Lifnim Mimenu Soreg Gavoa Asarat Tfachim, that the Soreg was there as a boundary, and it was Asarat Tfachim higher than the Temple Plaza. Ushlosh Esrei Pirtzot Hayubo Sheparzu Malchei Yavan, and there were 13 piercings into the Soreg that the Yavan made, the Greek Hellenists made, v'chazru v'gadrum, and they were redone, v'gazru k'neged shlosh esrei hishtachaviot, and that there was a takana made that you should bow in the places that they tried to pierce and destroy the Beit HaMikdash as a symbol that it was renewed. Now, this Soreg is also mentioned in Josephus in source number 4, and it would indicate the fact that foreigners, non-Jews, were forbidden to enter. We have the actual Soregs, or pieces of it. If you look at source 9 of your visual handout, you start to see it in both Greek and Latin. And just in case you don't read Greek and Latin, we've translated it for you. No foreigners to enter within this area. Whoever is caught will have himself blamed for his death, which follows. Not sure. There's no records of anyone ever being put to death for it, but I want to show you on page 9 of your visual presentation, this is where the Soreg was. It was the plaza was elevated at that point, and we have remnants in both Latin and Greek from that period of time. So we know what the Mishnah tells us. Actually, I mean, we know it because we trust the Mishnah, but we also have archaeological finds, and you can see those on pages sources 9 and sources on page 10. You see another Soreg. And if you turn to page 11, you actually see remainders of the Soreg even on the Temple Mount itself, which actually most recently has been a point of contention, as there is to be no changes of the archaeological topography of the Temple Mount, and yet there constantly is. And one thing that has been happening lately is a report that whatever remnants there are from 2,000 plus years of the Soreg are now being destroyed, to once again suggest that there was no temple that ever was there, and therefore any archaeological proofs are not to be put there. We also know, if we turn to page 12 of our visual presentation. We also know that there was cisterns of water that brought water to the Beit HaMikdash. And we know that there were two aqueducts, an upper and a lower aqueduct. You can see remnants of both of these aqueducts. The lower aqueduct was designed in the time of the Chashmonaim. An upper aqueduct was then designed by Herod. We have remnants of those aqueducts even now. I could show you remnants of those aqueducts. You can see them from Efrat or from other places. You could also see them in Yerushalayim itself, in Gehinnom, in some of the valleys. You can see them actually, if you, Tony, in between the arches, it's a restaurant in the Muslim quarter. If you go opposite that restaurant, there's actually remnants. If you enter into the Jaffa Gate and you walk on the left-hand side, you enter into the Jaffa Gate, you pass a block of stores and another block of stores. In between there is an entranceway. You go through that entranceway and you make a right, you can see remnants of the aqueduct. I would not suggest that anyone do that walk. I did it with a son. My son, who's a sharpshooter in the Israeli Army, it was okay to do. But I would not suggest doing that walk without somebody who can be there in case you encounter people who aren't happy that you're looking for those remnants. And we know that there were mikvahs on the Beis HaMikdash. We know that from the Gemara. We know it from the Mishnah. We also have remnants of those mikvahs. And here is at least two of the mikvahs that we have remnants from. And there is a third that's a question mark. I'm not sure of the authenticity of the third one, and therefore there's a question mark there, but definitely where one and two is, and these fit exactly in locations where the Mishnah discusses mikvos on the Beis HaMikdash. I want to just mention with source number 5 of our handout that the water for the mikvos is something that the Mishnah talks about and explains that the temple funds could be used to pay for these, for the cisterns, because they were for the public works projects of Yerushalayim, and the temple funds helped the public works projects of the entire region, because Yerushalayim, in many ways, has the halachic status of the Beis HaMikdash. And therefore, temple funds could be used for a matamayim, chomata'ir, v'chol tzorchei ha'ir. We know that the Yerushalayim has, the old city of Yerushalayim, or parts of the old city, has the halachic status of the Second Temple. We know that for a whole bunch of things, for a whole bunch of halachot. And by the way, and this also answers another thing, which is found on the next page of our handout, of our sources, page 4, and that is Masechet Yadayim, which speaks about the idea, we don't have time to get into it in great depth, it speaks about the idea of an amat mayim, a channel of water. And this we know happened within the aqueducts that brought water to the Beit HaMikdash, that if it travels within a stone container, even in a Beit HaKvarot, it does not become tameh. And there are certain protocols about it and things of that nature, but we know as you follow the lower and upper aqueducts that that exactly happened. This is why Masechet Yadayim has these conversations. I would like at this point in time to actually, if we can move to our visual presentation, I'd like to do the following. Not that there's not much to do on page 13 and 14, and well, we'll stop at 15 for a second because it actually speaks about the karbanot of a yoledet. We have a halacha that if a woman gives birth, she brings karbanot. And we know this from this week's Torah portion. If you look at source 8 of the handout and page 15 of our visual, we're told, v'lakachat shtei torim o shnei b'nei yona, echad la'ola v'echad l'chatat, that if she could not afford certain level of karbanot, she could bring a birds. And we know that we have found from the ruins of the Temple Mount a sign that said Karban with pictures of birds. You'll have to take my word that those are birds, but if you go to the Israel Museum, you can see it better. And it makes sense that a karban for a yoledet would have an exact directional, because that's not a karban that a woman would bring on a regular basis. It's when she had a child. And even if she had a child on a regular basis, there would still be a, you know, amount of time between each one, and we have those remnants. If we turn to first of all, you'll hear in the next, the Ketav, the Hebrew changes between the first and the second base of Mikdash, just from the second base of Mikdash. I assume that it's not a final, first of all, I'm not sure why it's that. Let me just say that. I'm making the following assumption that is only based on my own assumptions and has no, I've never done any real research on it. I would assume that when you're trying to chisel in stone, creating a line straight will not give you the same effect as a nun, which is much easier, readable much faster. I don't think with dirt and grit going into a stone that a final nun would have given you what you wanted to suggest, but a nun this way would. That's my own personal feeling about it, but there could be much better reason. I'm just giving you my reason. Okay? Good question. I'd like to just bring up something on page 9, which has changed my Tisha B'Av, and I'd like to share it with you. On page 9, for those of you who I'm sure are familiar with this, you're looking at the pedestrian walkway of the west of the southern western wall, the southwest corner. And a lot of people have probably seen the southwest corner. By a show of hands, who's been to the southwest corner? Okay, so a lot of you have seen that, so there's no need to talk about it, other than the fact that you still see the fallen stones from the second Beit HaMikdash. What? Page 16. What did I say? Oh, I'm sorry, page 16. Source number 9 in your handout. Source number 9, page 16. I got it mixed up. That's what happens when you try to do a PowerPoint presentation with two different handouts. So if you look at page 16, you'll see the southern western wall. You'll actually see some interesting things. For example, the chisel in the wall is because at a certain time, in order to show disgust to the Beit HaMikdash, there was certain communities built their homes against the wall of the Beit HaMikdash, the retaining wall of the Beit HaMikdash, and ran their pipes, especially the pipes for refuge and things of that nature, into the walls of here. We would be talking about the western walls, and therefore you see that chisel. To the left, you see actually the market stalls that people would buy their kabanot from when they got the right cash that they needed to buy, or other things that were bought there. But I want to point out to you something. You see the broken sidewalks from the Second Temple period that were broken because of the heavy Herodian stones that fell from the top of the Beit HaMikdash. If you actually look at the Plaza Hotel, the Plaza Hotel actually is really the size, the height, if you picture it, it's really the size of the Beit HaMikdash size was. So if you want to picture how tall it was, if you work it, I can work it out with you at a different time, but the Plaza Hotel basically fits the same size, height size. Josephus discusses the following, source number 9 in our handout. When Jews were running away from the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash from the upper city, you see the following. So they now left these towers of themselves, or rather they were ejected out of them by God himself, and led immediately to the valley that was under the Shilom, the Shiloah, where they again recovered themselves out of the dread that they were in for a while. And it goes on about the different things that happened there. And what it speaks about is the last 6 words of the first paragraph of source number 9 is, they went down into subterranean caverns. We know that when Herod rebuilt the Beit HaMikdash, He built a whole sewer system, subterranean caverns that carried the water and the debris away from the Beit HaMikdash and from the cities, the upper city and the lower city. We know about the subterranean caverns. We also know that Jews hid there from Josephus. Josephus also discusses how the Romans, when they found Jews hiding in these subterranean caverns, would take their daggers and they would break the sidewalks to kill Jews by simply just throwing their swords into, or hitting their swords into the Jews into these taverns, into these caverns. So you're picturing in your mind Jews from the upper city. They're escaping by going into the sewer systems, and they're hiding there. And some of them have some pots with food in it. They're dressed in whatever remnants they're wearing. They must probably carried a few things. Those caverns are very, 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 very small because they were made for refuge. They weren't made for people to walk in. Anyone ever go through Chizkiyahu's water tunnel? Chizkiyahu's water tunnel is wide and expansive compared to these caverns. That's how thin they are. We have found these caverns. We have found the caverns to the point where the end exit of these caverns is now surrounded by that gate on page 16. The caverns go more. They go further, but they haven't been totally all open to the community yet. But if you look at page 16 and you see that piece that is blocked by the fence, that's because you can only go into these. That's an exit. You start in the lower city of Jerusalem, in the city of David, and you walk your way up. You can only exit there, and they don't want anyone, God forbid, going in that way or getting caught in there, and therefore it is locked up. Anyone been in those caverns? Aren't they unbelievable? They're unbelievable. And you can see, actually, the places, you can see the holes still from the Romans breaking the sidewalks to kill Jews. And if you turn to the next page of your handout, not the visual presentation, there's an article from the Washington Post from 2007 that speaks about the finding of these caverns and the fact that there was debris found in there. A person's button, coins, other vessel fragments, and pottery shards, all from this time of 70 CE, the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. It's an extremely powerful piece. Now I would like to move. I think so, yes. Yeah. The article explains that more. There were bones found, but I think more were remnant pieces. Again, you can just actually Google this and you'll find more and more information, but I just want to bring it to your attention because it's just a very powerful thing. I want to just spend the next 10 minutes or maybe 12 minutes on the following piece to move us back to the time of the first Beit HaMikdash. And I would like to do the following. In order to make this a little bit more, to explain it more, we're going to spend our time on the visuals and then we're going to look at the Makorot. Okay? Spend our time on the visuals and then look at the Makorot. We'll spend like 6 minutes or so on the visuals and another 6 minutes on the Makorot. You have in the British Museum, which is basically made up of materials that they borrowed from all of the various parts of the world that they colonized, and they use borrowed because it's going to be in YU Torah, the Lachish Relief. The Lachish Relief, which also is representative of Sancheirev's palace in Nineveh, discusses the idea that when Lachish and Malchei Yisrael and the Israelite kingdom was destroyed, how the Jews were marched, as other nations were, into their own diasporas. If you notice on page 17, the Lachish is destroyed in Lachish is destroyed during the time of the destruction of Malchei Yisrael. Lachish is 40 kilometers south of Yerushalayim. And you'll notice, first of all, the following thing about this picture, which is, I think, if you look at the other reliefs in the British Museum, you'll realize this. The first thing is, notice the tzniut of both the men and the women in this picture. And the reason why you know it's distinct and unique is because when you see other nations that are marched out of their homelands, that same tzniut is not represented. So just the tzniut. And the other thing you notice is that the children are being protected by the parents, which is also not reflective of all the other reliefs that you see in the British Museum of Sancheirev depicting the diasporas of other nations. Again, something that I don't think should be lost upon us. If you turn to the next page, this is an important page. It explains you what happens with the walls around Yerushalayim. The walls around Yerushalayim are developed in stages. You have two sets of walls here. You have the black walls and the pink or the red dotted walls. The black wall is the current Ottoman wall. It's a fairly recent wall, just a few hundred years old. The pink walls represent walls from the time first of the city of David, Ir David, extended to include the Temple Mount, and eventually extended to include the valleys, which it no longer includes, and part of what we know now as the Old City. And this extension of the first temple walls is when the Malchei Yisrael, when the Israelite kingdom was destroyed, refugees were coming to Jerusalem. You needed to expand the city of Jerusalem, and you needed to include a larger area to protect those refugees. And this is the wall structure. So there are remnants of the wall structure that intersect. So for example, if you look at Migdal David and those areas, you will find parts from the first base of Migdash, you will find parts from the second base of Migdash, you will find parts that are later. If you actually walk in the middle of the old city, you will see something called the Broad Wall. That's this wall. By a show of hands, how many people have seen the Broad Wall in the middle of the old city? That's part of this wall. That's part of the wall that we're talking about, the pink wall. That's why it's there. In fact, if you turn to page 21 of our visual presentation, you will see the Broad Wall. This is part of that pink reddish wall that is found on page 18 of your visual presentation. Okay? What happens is that when Chizkiyahu is concerned that Sancheirev, who destroys Lachish, which is only 40 kilometers away near Hebron, where he's concerned about that, he starts to do things to protect Yerushalayim. The first thing he does is he strengthens those reddish pink walls that are on page 18 of your handout. And he creates what we call a broader wall. It's larger and it's taller, a broad wall. He does another thing, and that is he decides that when they encamp around there, they're going to want a water source. And so what they want to do basically is he wants to make sure that Sancheirev's troops have no water. So the Gihon Spring, which is found right outside of the old city of Jerusalem, the old city from the city of David, the city where we have a wall still from the time of Avram Avinu, he wants to make sure that there isn't free Perrier water for all of Sancheirev's soldiers. So he redirects the water cisterns. And if you look at that blue line that's on page 18 of your handout, you will see that is the redirection by Chizkiyahu HaMelech of the water source. So when they get there, there's basically no water for Sancheirev's armies to drink from. He thinks there's water there, but there's no water there. In fact, if you turn to the next page of your visual presentation, you will see the Gihon Springs, page 19. It's outside the wall of the lower city, of the city of David. And what happens is he redirects the water source by creating Chizkiyahu's tunnel. There's a fissure in below ground where you can still breathe, and he has two sets of people working 24, maybe 24/7, to basically chisel out a way to redirect the water source. And when they actually reach the area in which they come together, you see on page 20, you will actually see a Hebrew type of Ktav Ivri, of the older type of Hebrew, First Temple Hebrew, and you'll see that they actually, this is where we met, this is where we come together, two sets of people chiseling, and if you ever walk the Chizkiyahu's tunnel and you feel the sides, you can still feel the chiseling, and at a certain point the chiseling changes directions, because you had two different groups, the grooves changed directions, because you had two different groups walking. This was borrowed by the Ottoman Turks, because it was found during their time in the holding on to Palestine, and this is found in the Museum of Istanbul, borrowed again from the State of Israel. And the only reason why you don't have the complete piece is that when it was taken down to be brought in this temple, they broke off a piece, and therefore some of the Hebrew on top, the triangles almost to say on top, is broken. If you look at the sources now, let me just point out one thing before we get to the sources, because I really want to honor the time. Look at the final page of the handout. You will see the broad wall actually intersects. You'll see where the cat is there, and the other things there. You'll see it intersects with homes. The broad wall was in the poorest area. Now it's, you know, $3 million a meter to buy there. But basically, it was the poorest area. It was where the refugees were. And Chizkiyahu had extended the wall, and it went over to some of the poor homes there. Let's look at our sources now. Source on page 6, source number 10. Yeshayahu yells at Chizkiyah, "Do not destroy the water cisterns. Do not destroy the poor people's homes. God will protect you. You have seen also the source number 10 on page 6 of our handout. You have also seen the breaches of the city of David, that they are many, and you gathered together the waters of the lower pool." That's redoing the Chizkiyah tunnels. "And you have counted the houses of Jerusalem and the houses that you have broken down to fortify the walls." Yeshayahu is yelling at Chizkiyahu for destroying the homes to build the walls. I'm showing you the pictures of some of the homes he destroyed in order to build the wall. You can see the pictures. "You have made also a pond between the two walls for the water of the old pool." You moved the water into the Shiloach area. "You did all these things, but you have not looked to him who made it, nor do you see him who's fashioned it long ago." You're doing things that God does not want you to do, Chizkiyahu. Don't destroy the poor people's homes. Don't redirect the water. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to take care of it. And by the way, when Nehemiah speaks later on about rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash, he speaks about the fact that he rebuilds Ad Choma HaRechava, until the broad walls. Those are the walls that we spoke about. In Divrei Hayamim, you have the conversation where Yechizkiyahu sees that Sancheirav is coming. He brings all the people together. Source 12, page 6. And if you look at Pasuk Dalet, Vayikabsu Am Rav, he brings a lot of people together. Vayistamu as Kol HaMayanot. He wants to stuff up all of the external water cisterns. That is the redoing. That is why it's called the Chizkiyahu's tunnel. And if you turn to the page 8 of our handout, the final page of the handout, you'll see that the Gemara says in Brachas, Tanu Rabbanan, Shisha Dvar Masa Chizkiyahu HaMelech, Al Shlosha Hodu Lo, Al Shlosha Lo Hodu Lo. And three, the rabbis were very happy, and three, they were very concerned. Let's look at the three that they were very concerned. I apologize that we're not focusing on as positives, but just the negatives. Al Shlosha Lo Hodu Lo, Satan Me Gichon. He redirected the water cisterns of the Gihon spring. But Yeshayahu tells him about. Below Hodulo, and he did not ask permission. Kitzei Talatot Heichal. He cut off the Heichal's doors to try to get the Assyrian, to try to bribe the Assyrian king. Avar Nisan B'Nisan, and he added an extra month of Nisan. My point here is that everything that you see from an archaeological perspective, the redirection of the water sources, the concern about the broad wall destroying the homes of the poor, everything that you see in the archaeology is well found in Tanakh. And you see The ancient inscription in Chizkiyahu's tunnel, this is what we can make out. The tunnel, and this is the story of the tunnel, while the axes were against each other and while three cubits were left to cut, the voice of a man called to his counterpoint, for there was Zeta in the rock. I don't know what that means. On the right, and on the day of the tunnel being finished, the stonecutters struck each other towards his counterpart. Axe against axe flowed water from the source of the pool for 1,200 cubits, and whatever cubits was the height over the head of the stonecutters. That is the remnant piece that is still found in the museum in Istanbul. At a time in which we celebrate the birthday of Hakamat Medina Yisrael, the gift that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given us, of Rishit Smichat Gulatenu, we are to be reminded of the fact that all we need to do is walk the streets of Yerushalayim, and we see our past, we visualize, we're able to touch our present, and hopefully we're able to think of a very positive future, not one based on war, not one in which Rabbi Meir Schlesinger, who was the Rosh Yeshiva Shalvim when I was there, would tell us that the fact that Israeli soldiers have to walk around with guns doesn't show how strong we are. It actually shows how weak we are. Maybe there will come a time that our children will not need to walk around with guns. Maybe there will come a time in which our children will be able to walk the streets of Yerushalayim in safety without the need of that type of protection. But I think what we need to do in our own ishtadlus is to never forget the fact that Yerushalayim has been part of our DNA from our birth as a nation, and all you need to do is look at our Talmudic sources, our Tanakh sources, and the archaeology, and to see the sacred symphony that they create in our relationship to the city of Yerushalayim and to the land of Eretz Israel in general. Thank you very much.